Sup, freaks, it's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. Really good conversation with Eric Yakes talking about banks without bankers. We can build it with Bitcoin. Don't get fooled by the ETF. We don't need the bankers and their banks. We can build banks without bankers using things like Fedi Mints and other second layer solutions on Bitcoin and just native multisig. It's a beautiful thing. This rip was brought to you by our good friends at River. ETFs are here. You sitting there listening to this, you don't have any Bitcoin, you think about buying the ETF? I wouldn't. You have to buy Bitcoin directly. Who knows what's going to happen with the ETFs over the long run? You always want the ability to take your Bitcoin into self-custody. River is the best place to do that, the best place to stack sats. They make it extremely easy. If you dollar cost average into Bitcoin using River, you don't pay any fees. You set it and forget it. If you want to set limit orders, maybe you're thinking the ETF launch will bring a lot of volatility. You want to buy at a lower price or a higher price, you can set those limit orders within the app. They also just released River Links, which is the best way to gift Bitcoin. You create a River Link with a certain amount of Bitcoin you want to gift somebody, and then you simply send them the link. You can text it to them. You can email it to them. Send it over Twitter DMs, however you want to get it to them. It's the best way to gift Bitcoin. You send them the link. They hit the link. They sweep the Bitcoin either to their River account or a non-custodial wallet, any wallet they choose. It could be a custodial wallet for that matter as well. Any wallet that they want over Lightning and on-chain after certain thresholds. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You're going to get $5 worth of Bitcoin. ETFs are here. Where are you? Use the best Bitcoin exchange, River. Proud to have them as a sponsor. Also proud to have our good friends down the hall, Unchained, as a sponsor. Once you buy your Bitcoin, you're looking to secure it. You can set up a 2 or 3 multi-sig vault at Unchained where you hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. Distributed collaborative custody. Eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. Make sure that your Bitcoin is secure in cold storage off the exchange. Unchained as a trading desk where you can buy and send it directly into that multi-sig cold storage vault. And they also have an RIA product that leverages a 2 or 3 multi-sig model, the collaborative custody model. So if you want to transition your fiat IRA, they have an IRA as well, sound advisory, but the IRA, we're talking about the IRA. If you want to transition your IRA into Bitcoin, Unchained makes it very easy. Set up a call with their team to figure out how to do that today. Get, if you're going to have Bitcoin in your IRA, it should be real Bitcoin, not the ETF. Go to unchained.com/consultation, set up a call with their team to learn more about their IRA product. This rip was also brought to you by good friends at Crowd Health. Crowd Health is here to really disrupt healthcare and how you pay for that healthcare. Health insurance is notoriously opaque, impersonal, expensive. Crowd Health is here to help that. It's not health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. They have an incredible community. I and my family are part of that community. We've been in it for 2 years now, and we're loving it. The way it works, you pay a monthly fee. You're part of the community. If you ever have a medical event, you go to the doctor. You tell Crowd Health, hey, I'm going to go to the doctor. They say, okay, give us the bill when you're done. You go to the doctor. You give Crowd Health the bill. They negotiate it lower. And you pay the first $500 of that bill. And then the rest gets crowdfunded by the community. 100% of the bills that have been brought to CrowdHealth to date have been paid. Can't guarantee it, but the model is working. I've seen it myself. I've used it, I think, 4 times in the last 12 months. It's worked beautifully. It's cheaper. It's very personal. You get a dedicated healthcare advocate from CrowdHealth to walk you through the process. And it's a good community. Healthy people, a lot of Bitcoiners, and people looking to opt out of the healthcare system, the health insurance system, excuse me. And they've got a list of very good healthcare providers, very good doctors. A couple of them were speaking today at the Commons. One of them, Veronica, our doctor in my family. Highly recommend it. If you're on COBRA, if your company health insurance is expensive, if your deductible is thousands of dollars, you'll never reach it. I think CrowdHealth is a better option. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You'll get $99 for your first 6 months of membership fees. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by Bitcoin Talent Co. Bitcoin Talent Co. is a recruiting company built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They just launched a new portal. So go to bitcointalent.co. Check it out. If you're looking to get hired in the space, set up your profile. They're really expanding what they're doing at Bitcoin Talent Co. Obviously, they have the run-of-the-mill recruiting services of your company looking to hire. They will work with you to understand your needs, what you're looking for. They have the network and the Bitcoin knowledge to go find what you need in terms of talent, maybe in the tech sector, maybe in the banking sector, maybe in the design sector. They will go find it. They have their Flex product. Maybe you need contract work. Maybe you need a contract CFO or executive to only work part-time. They have a roster of people willing to do that. Maybe you need an engineering sprint and a design sprint. You can engage with their Flex product. And again, they just released this whole new platform. So if you're looking to get hired in the space, go to bitcointalent.co, set up a profile, get your resume in the mix, get your profile in the mix, and come on. We got to build the Bitcoin standard. I don't think the ETF guys are going to do it. We're going to do it. And Bitcoin Talent Co. is going to help you find the places that are doing. So go to bitcointalent.co, tell them that TFTC sent you, and enjoy this rip with our good friend, Eric Yakes. Tiki.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Sup, freaks, it's your boy Marty Bent here with another episode of TFTC on a momentous day in Bitcoin's history. The ETFs officially started trading. Everybody is making fun of Vanguard and others who are blocking people from buying the Bitcoin ETFs. But we're here with Eric Yakes to talk about something that's actually cool, replacing the banks with Bitcoin. Eric is the author of The Seventh Property, Bitcoin and the Monetary Revolution, and he recently wrote a post for Axiom, Banks Without Bankers. And it's actually also prescient that we're talking about this today, Eric, because it's the anniversary of the running Bitcoin, or the day after the anniversary of the running Bitcoin tweet by Hal Finney. And Hal Finney is known in the space for writing a very prescient blog post or forum post in BitcoinTalk.org on December 30th, 2010, talking about how Bitcoin would enable a free banking system. And your piece really dives into how we can do that natively on Bitcoin. So first, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's been a long time coming.
It really has. And I'm very excited we waited this long because I think this particular topic is fascinating, important, and flying under the radar right now, as the narrative with the ETFs is that Bitcoin's merging with the incumbent financial system. It's going to become a part of the banking system, the financial system, and it's just going to fit into what has already been built. And a lot of the people that are pushing this narrative, in my opinion, are completely neglecting the fact that we have this open source protocol and now these layers being built on top of it that enable completely new ways of interacting with money and financial services. And this is really what you dove into in your piece, Banks Without Bankers. So can we really have a future where we have banks without bankers?
I think it's like, I was actually watching the What Bitcoin Did with Giacomo and John Carvalho and Matt Carallo last night. And, you know, they're getting deep into the scaling debate. And it was interesting because they kind of framed some of these topics in a way that I guess I didn't frame it in my paper this way, but I think it's helpful context because I think, you know, probably a good amount of listeners are probably thinking about it in a similar way. But, you know, they're framing it from the perspective of like there's the custodial banking type models and then there's the unilateral exit type models. One is kind of a part of Bitcoin, one isn't. And or at least John, I think, was framing it this way. And then I think that like a lot of the debate comes from, is it like they're this binary way that we're going to be thinking about our financial system and the ecosystem built around Bitcoin, or is this actually more of a spectrum of trust models that we're looking at? And depending on the use case, depending on the technology, depending on the timing, and depending on, you know, what consumers are ultimately demanding, where on that spectrum are we going to fall in terms of the amount of trust and how much custody really exists within the system? And I feel like that's kind of a key debate. And like, I view this as much more of a spectrum. I think that, you know, you can't, the second that you take these ideas and you bring things to extremes, and that's kind of what I try to do at the beginning of the paper is say, like, we have this world where we have all custodial, you know, digital gold 2.0 Bitcoin. It has the same, you know, freedom enabling qualities as a bumper sticker. And, you know, we get a $12 trillion market cap. And a lot of the innovations of the technology is wasted. And that at the other end of the spectrum, we have this completely, you know, decentralized, permissionless, peer-to-peer, global, neutral, apolitical type monetary system. And that also seems a bit extreme, given the constraints that we're aware of at a technological level. And I think a lot of my writing tries to focus on, you know, how these systems are going to be optimized, where I think we're going to have self-custodial use cases, and that's going to be a very large material proportion of the market. And I'm not really sure what that comes out to. I think that there is some sort of, you know, theoretical amount. It's like there needs to be X proportion of Bitcoin within this economy that is ultimately self-custodial. And if it's not, and if people can't exit into that system voluntarily to a degree, then there is a risk of political capture in the long run over the system. So I think that's one of the goals, is the whole system doesn't need to be this you know, purely self-custodial decentralized system, but it needs to be enough to act as a deterrence mechanism against political capture of the system. I think as long as political capture isn't influencing the financial system, then a lot of the problems that we witnessed with banking systems throughout history start to go away. And it doesn't mean they're perfect, but at least they're free markets, and people get to choose what they want, and banks can respond to that. And the argument that I'm basically making to tie this all out in the paper is that I think that when it comes to custodial models, we can use cryptography to optimize some of the agency problems that have existed in banks for a long time. And those innovations are still occurring with builders today within the ecosystem. And I think that we're really optimizing agency in different ways, to where I see the custodial market probably being significant, drastically different than what it's been historically. And we could probably get this hyper-efficient, informationally transparent financial system to emerge from the first time. And like, from my perspective, if the goal of Bitcoin, and, you know, I think people have different goals of Bitcoin, but like my goal for Bitcoin is I think it needs to be a settlement layer for a neutral monetary system. Just needs to be a monetary system that's not influenced by any particular person. And I think if we can achieve that, then that's going to change the world in a significant way. And that's why these questions matter so much.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it goes to both extremes. I'm sorry, someone's coming in. Your stuff's right there behind you. People take it to both extremes and say, like, we need everybody to be self-sovereign, or it's going to be completely cucked by the financial system. And I mean, again, going back to Hal's post, I think as Bitcoiners, we need to recognize the fundamental limitations, particularly at the protocol level, that make it literally impossible. There's no way on earth that you can have a UTXO for each person, let alone a large portion of the global population. And with that in mind, like, you have to accept that there are trade-offs, and that's why the Lightning Network exists. We'll talk about Fediments a lot this episode. That's why they exist. That's why Liquid exists. That's why exchanges exist to a certain extent. And it's becoming comfortable with those trade-offs, but at the same time, making sure that the trade-offs that are made are worthwhile and do preserve the neutral state of the network that you explained. And I think that makes a lot of people butthurt, but it is the reality. Like, unless we get covenants and some ability to do partial ownership of UTXOs, and yeah, maybe we can scale it to more people, but even that comes with some cost trade-offs that probably will price people out in the long run.
Exactly. And like, it's until we solve this fundamental economic problem of, you know, efficiency, the trade-off between efficiency and, you know, neutrality or security, or however you want to frame it, we're always going to be dealing with this. But I think that, like, the one framework that I think kind of helps us, in the same way that we think about how this fiat system has created malinvestment throughout the economy, the political capture of the system has created a lot of malagency So like that's kind of like how I, if I were to break it down fundamentally to the economic problem, Bitcoin solved agency for like base layer settlement. We have all the properties of gold. We made it much more efficient. It can do a lot more things now. And it's much better than the US dollar settlement system today as well. So we created this new innovation that solved for all this agency. All these people that were formerly involved in this have been automated away in a trustless way. And we can do that permissionlessly now. So like that's a major innovation. And I think that we're in the same way that Bitcoin applied cryptography and cleverly aligned incentives to make that happen. I think that we can do a similar thing where there's like this malagency and all these other financial functions that exist when it comes to like the different means of payment that would be used and how many service providers are required to create verification between different means of payments, between banking systems. It just, it's bloated. It's inefficient. It's a lot of it's just there because of the administrative burdens that regulatory environments create. And you know, the barriers to entry and the lack of competition that creates too. So it's, I think a lot of it is really just, we can kill off a lot of this malagency within financial functions and significantly improve custodial banking models by doing that.
And so how do Fedimints play into this in your mind? First, let's explain Fedimints, because I have been bullish on Fedimints since Eric dropped the first email on the mailing list, came out the prototype when him, I believe, Casey Roadarmer and Obi were on stage at Bitcoin 2022 explaining Fedimints. And then obviously it's actually even more prescient that we're talking now. You had Fedimint version 0.2.1 drop last week, which is the first sort of stable release that people can feel confident building on. Everything from here on out will be backwards compatible. So it seems like Fedimints are officially released and able to be built on in the wild in a somewhat reliable fashion.
Yeah. Like I'll start with a Fedimint as it's just a technology. And I think that there's a lot of different ways that it could be applied. I think that there's different narratives. There's all these narratives that have emerged around what a Fedimint can be. And it's like, I'm probably deriving my, that's what I am doing in this piece, is deriving my own narratives about it. I could be dead wrong. Other people could be dead wrong. And we'll see how it's ultimately applied. But fundamentally, a Fedimint is a set of protocols that's designed to be compatible with the Bitcoin network and the Lightning network, that is enabling a less constrained means of payment, is kind of how I categorize it. Like when we think about how we're scaling Bitcoin, and then we think about some of the problems that Lightning is running into, where inbound liquidity is this major issue, and we think that that might incentivize centralization of the network over time. And Lightning has its set of benefits. I think that eCash is this, it's this optimization towards, okay, it's the least constrained means of payment that is also, nearly best practices in terms of privacy, if not the, and, it doesn't require the inefficiency of a blockchain. It is just a bare asset, very similar to like a cash instrument. Now that requires taking on a lot more trust. So we have to send Bitcoin to a multisig address, and then they use a Chami and blind signature protocol to issue you an eCash token. And when that happens, right, if you're using it from a mobile app on your phone, then you literally have memory for this eCash token on your phone, just like it would be like having cash in your wallet. If you lose your wallet, it's gone. There's ways of backing it up and other things, but and I won't get into technical details around that, but there's definitely solutions so that it's not just like if you drop your phone in the toilet, your money's gone. But in any event, this is like another means of payment in the same way that, for a while I was kind of like, is Lightning the same thing as Bitcoin? It has different trust. It has different security trade-offs with operating in that kind of a system. And I think ultimately what it comes down to is I think it's better to think about these things as a different means of payment in the same way that, we have cash, checks, wires, and all these other different means of payment for a US dollar medium of exchange. And we have protocols emerging on Bitcoin that I think are doing a similar thing. So Fedimints are depositing your Bitcoin to a multisig address and trying to optimize that address based on trust. and then receiving an eCash token in return that allows you to very cheaply, privately, efficiently transact with people so that you can try to minimize. And it doesn't, it's not perfect, right? We still have to figure out, you know, how to reduce on-chain footprint. But putting that aside, I think that having like an eCash token is something that, out of all the custodial models, as opposed to just having an account at an exchange, out of all the custodial models, this is effectively like this way of minimizing trust by using federated technology for custody and optimizing your trust around who you want to trust. And like, that's the key ingredient, I think, when it comes to trust, is we need to create tools that allow us to, we need to create tools that make the marginal cost of moving our trust as low as possible. So when you think about depositing into a bank and trusting a bank with different things and how you would verify your trust in that bank, it's a very opaque, very expensive process. And I think what we're doing with some of these technologies is we're leveraging cryptography to make a lot of that actually very cheap. So it's like, I don't have to trust one single point of failure. I can trust a federation of people who have, you know, multiple keys. I can optimize that not to be some random bank that's like, you know, I've never used before, but just has the utility that I want. But I can actually have the key holders be people who I trust and I know in my day-to-day life, the same way that we trust people and we know in our day-to-day lives with everything else. There's a possibility for that. It also could be institutionalized. There's different ways that it could be done. You could optimize trust in a different way. But nonetheless, by using a technology that allows us to apply our trust to one group, immediately be able to exit that group very efficiently and move to another group, all in this digital format, I think it creates a much cheaper way for us to do that. And that's even, you know, similar to the innovation of like shared custodial models with the multisig transaction, right? Like, until Bitcoin and we could create these multi-signature transaction schemes, there wasn't really a cheap way of having like a shared custodial scheme. It was a much more inefficient hands-on approach that you would have to go through with a relationship with the bank. And we're like, shared custody has pushed the marginal cost of creating that to, you know, very, very low. And I think that we're yet to see the economic benefits that come from this new shared custodial, a lot of the innovations that I think that are going to emerge from shared custodial models. And so like, that's kind of the first piece of like, what is a Fediment and how it ties in. I think it's optimizing for agency around custodial models by using federated architecture. And then I think the next big distinction between it and like something like Liquid or any other application of a blockchain is that it's not a blockchain. It's simply just a bare instrument that's private, similar to how many means of payment we have today work. And that's one of the key questions, right? Like, how many times do we need to be applying a blockchain for something? How public do we want a lot of things to be? Auditability is important in some cases. And the argument is, to achieve auditability, do you need to have a consensus mechanism and a blockchain, or is there better methods of doing that as well? If we don't want auditability for something, then something like eCash is probably an ideal construct by not leveraging a blockchain because it's not constrained. And I think that's one of the next major innovations, something that makes it pretty unique to anything else that's really come, is it's at this confluence of distinctions kind of at each level between how it interacts with base chain, the actual asset, and the way that the Chime and eCash is set up. And then like the capacity constraints around that too. So I guess that's probably a good place to stop on like the overview of it.
Yeah. And digging into the particular trade-offs of the trust model, obviously, since it's federated, I think to begin, like, because that's the other thing with like these federated Chami and Mint, they operate in this regulatory gray area, if you will. So it'll probably be a lot of quasi anonymous mints popping up with quasi-anonymous, pseudo-anonymous federated members controlling the mint. But ideally, if this were this technology, which I would argue is technologically superior than the incumbent system on many levels, like if you were to run with the assumption that like people come to their senses and recognize that we have a much better technology to do these things and allow people to basically create this free banking system that Hal Finney wrote about in 2010 and publicly market, like, hey, yes, I'm a Federation member in this particular mint. You could basically do a trust analysis of the Federation members and whether or not you trust them to actually sign transactions and to make sure that they don't rug you, they don't steal Bitcoin, collude to steal Bitcoin from the mint. And again, playing a hypothetical where the world comes to its senses and you're able to have this free market competition for mint users by Federation members, and they're basically competing on reputation, their ability to successfully facilitate mint operations. Like, that is significantly better than going to a JP Morgan and trusting Jamie Dimon and his board of directors and all their managers to manage their singular bank correctly. So that's like the one. You're distributing that trust amongst multiple stakeholders who, if they were able to be public, were probably unlikely to collude because they'll probably have other business operations and they want to ruin their whole business reputation on just colluding to rug a mint specifically. And then number two, the privacy benefit is massive, where if you enter a mint and you engage in commerce using these eCash tokens, the likelihood that you will get debanked because you made a transaction that the bank did not agree with from a political perspective, like, that is simply impossible. Because yes, the bank can see that people are spending eCash tokens, but they don't really know exactly who.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think that, like, so there's, and I feel like a lot of people talk about some of these, like the benefits of something like a FediMint at a micro level. But I think there's two primary frames. There's the micro and then there's the macro, the systemic level. And how could this work is like an actual banking system. And that's where a lot of the free banking theory starts to come in. And I think that that's what Hal was thinking about. I think that Hal hadn't considered the ways that we could apply innovative new technologies to building out a free banking system natively. I think what he's describing it as, like, the system of, like, banks and competing notes. It's like he was thinking it as more of like the analog type structure. And I think that what a lot can be done to actually remove trust and you know, actual bankers from, like, many of these functions can be automated as well. And I think that's kind of like the distinction. And when you get into like the free banking theory, I guess I can just give like a quick overview on what that is. It's basically, the idea is that from the point at which we moved out of direct monetary medium settlement to note-based systems, and that was kind of like the dawn of our modern banking systems. And, you know, for, at least within the Western world, this emerged around the 17th century. It's because money had to keep up with technology, right? And after we had like the printing press emerge and people realized that conducting trade over long distances using precious metals was a very expensive task, if we were to custody our assets within a bank that can issue a note and we can use, you know, eventually we had the telegraph for it, but, you know, we can use paper receipts to conduct trade. With the trust, assuming that is, you know, that was a very efficient mechanism. That was a scaling mechanism from the precious metal era that emerged. And in governments very quickly co-opted that system because it's opaque and it creates centralized control over the asset. So it was a prime example of how political capture can occur very quickly when we saw the history of what happened with the Bank of England and how central banking first emerged, because there is a natural need to create these branch tree based structures within a financial system so that you can optimize for highways and roads and, you know, streets on a neighborhood, and the governments can take advantage of the highways. So I think that the whole goal is, you know, how do we keep these things free? And, you know, luckily we have a few examples in history where they were relatively free and they weren't captured by governments. Of course, all of these things are a spectrum. It's not some sort of like binary consideration. A lot of people think about the US wildcat banking system as like free banking. I think if you get into the literature, or at least it's a lot wouldn't consider that to be a good example or even definitionally accurate to call it free banking. There was a lot of government influence. Like there was bond collateral laws where banks weren't, you know, allowed to freely choose what they wanted to use as a reserve asset. And they did have to have a certain percentage in their state level bonds. I think New England was like the first to implement that type of policy. And all these things, you know, they fuck with the market incentives, and things don't go very well when you start to fuck with market incentives. But the two primary examples that are leaned on is in the Scottish free banking system and the Canadian free banking system. And those were in like the 18th and 19th centuries. And like the Scottish free banking system was certainly not perfect. And of course, when you have market-based systems and you have governments influencing other things like war and their competing international banking systems, it's very hard to operate in a free way when you have these types of considerations that are shocking your system over time. But nonetheless, the Scottish free banking system lasted for over a century, and it allowed banks to freely conduct commerce in the way that they did. And that meant like in the early days of the system, they were fractionally reserving at like 20%, 10 to 20% range. And then over time that started to come down pretty significantly. I think that there's a lot of arguments as to why. I think the majority of it is that that's how much they could get away with given the market efficiency and the information transparency. But you know, like at the Keynesian direction, there's economists that make an argument that like by fractionally reserving and expanding credit, it's a response to a natural market demand. And it's facilitating a need within an economy. And that's why it occurred. And I think that I don't really agree with that, but I think that it's one of these things that while I don't believe fractional reserve is just or true, I would fall on the side where if a free market chooses something, I prefer that to be a case. I think that some Austrians would fall on the side that, you know, I think so Mises was a good example of one who believed that the government should intervene and, you know, make it so the fractional reserve doesn't exist within a banking system. And I don't think that's right either. But, you know, there's different views on like what the solution is, and generally where I fall is it should be a natural market mechanism. But what we saw in those systems was it was a natural market mechanism. And in these free banking systems, they were good in terms of, you know, that these were prosperous periods oftentimes. And the idea is that they were creating economic wealth, whether that was from credit or just because we had an efficient system in general, is a highly debated topic amongst economists. But nonetheless, I think that like taking that background on free banking, I think that a lot of the reasons that those systems ended up in fractional reserve in a digital world with the internet, with base settlement layer assets that have a unilateral exit or a fallback to a system, of, you know, peer to peer for the first time in history, I think that that incentive creates a new vector of competition within banking systems, that fundamentally changes the incentives. And because of that, I think that we could actually have very hyper-efficient, informationally transparent systems. And I think Fedimint is one protocol that could be a part of that potentially, as well as the Lightning Network, as well as other concepts that are, you know, currently emerging. And I think that if we can achieve that, we could actually create something that is a truly neutral type of monetary system and provides the consumer experience that we want. I think the goal is, going back to the point of like optimizing around agency. I think that a lot of people are looking at the scaling debates from purely a technological standpoint. And while I think that's incredibly valuable and incredibly important, I'm starting to think that by accepting trust in certain areas and actually just coming up with clever ways to align incentives, that is probably a way that we're actually going to have innovation emerge within these protocols and the way that they interact with one another. We might be able to accomplish things that we hadn't been able to accomplish before in prior financial systems. So like, I think that that's one of the key things that like learning from what Bitcoin did, we can apply to some of these other protocols where Bitcoin wasn't just combining, you know, digital signature algorithms and hash functions and blockchain database structure. And, you know, it wasn't just a combination of these technologies, but it was cleverly aligning the incentives of all of these technologies, putting in the final missing piece of proof of work and a difficulty adjustment, and then having that all work. And it, like, that's a really beautiful thing, getting the incentives to align properly, and then building a community and a culture that enables that to persist is, I think that you could argue is one of the primary innovations that existed within Bitcoin. And I think that that's what we're trying to accomplish today within other trust models.
And particularly with Fedimint, how do you view that incentive, that proper incentive system forming?
It's like, I don't know, right? But like, I write about some ideas that I think are interesting. I think a good example of this is like, okay, so we're accepting trust going into a multi-sig, and then we might be able to optimize that. We might get rugged, but we're going to be able to use the Zcash, and it's going to be a lot more efficient. And then the question is like, okay, going back to that point about how like shared custodial models are like making the cost of shared custody approach, the marginal cost is like approaching a very low amount. We can apply a very similar thing to verification of a bank itself, right? Like if you view a Fedimint as a bank, and it doesn't even have this like auditable blockchain, but I think what's really cool is this proposal that Calais, who created the Cashew protocol, which is also an eCash protocol leveraging Lightning and not using federated technology. But he created this proposal that is developed. The first time I actually read about it was from the Script project in 2017. But it was much more developed around the idea of verifying bank runs effectively. It's like basically creating an automated bank run system. And it's like, okay, so if we were to implement this in, say, like wallet technologies, you're a wallet, you're interacting with a Fedimint, and your wallet will only participate in Fedimints that, you know, abide by this kind of a standard. And we see that today in the financial economy for a lot of things. Like there's certain accreditations that exist, and there's people that only deal with, or there's natural industry standards that emerge based on certain accreditations or best practices that firms need to follow. You know, like audits being a great example. And this is kind of just like a way of, a much cheaper way of conducting automated forms of audit on a Fedimint, because a Fedimint does have the ability to produce reports of how much eCash it's issued. It can't say who has it or where, but it can give you total amounts. So like we could actually audit the fractional reserve. The question is what the mint is reporting true? And with the scheme that he's proposing, it's basically like if you're a mint and you publicly commit to rotating your eCash, so like eCash you issue has, could be anything, call it a 1 year, 2 year expiration on it. And then you produce like publicly auditable eCash tokens in the form of like a mint proof. And you produce publicly auditable redemptions of eCash tokens, then you can find what the net difference would be between. And how mints would cheat is they would either, if they, you know, issue too many, they would try to make fake redemptions, or they could make fake issuance. And there's ways in which consumers can actually voluntarily report or catch a mint if their eCash token doesn't exist within the list because it was arbitrarily burned from their list and they're not reporting it. Or on the other side, if, you know, nobody else really sees a way that they could find any, some, there's some fake things that nobody else can verify. None of these provide, it's like a consumer reporting type mechanism that can basically be automated within a wallet system. And none of these things create a perfect way of catching a mint, but what it does is it basically makes it probabilistically certain on a long enough timeline that a mint will get caught from running a fractional reserve, in which case that changes the incentives for the mint. It's not a perfect technological solution, but it changes the incentives of the mint so that the mint is just like, okay, well, am I going to pursue this as a long-term business model? Because I know I'm eventually going to get caught. Maybe I won't try to rug anybody. I'm actually going to try to pursue a full reserve. Or at the other end of the spectrum, maybe the market demands it and then it does actually exist. But if the market doesn't demand it, I think that there's ways to create, to capture and isolate the goal of information transparency within a trusted system without actually having to be fully transparent with like an auditable public ledger. And I think that's a really cool innovation, right? Like, I think that having something like that is, it's a leveraging cryptography to allow us to reveal and find information that we choose with optionality rather than having it be forced. Like, how much public data is being revealed on blockchains being arbitrarily applied to all these systems? It's either irrelevant or completely unnecessary to be revealed. And we can create systems that are actually much more efficient with how we're doing that and allow us to achieve the goal of, we really just want to audit this bank to make sure we're not just getting slow rubbed. Ideally, we have a federated system with a group of people we trust, and we're not just going to get rugged overnight. And if that is the case, then the question is, well, maybe they have an incentive to try to slow rug us over time by increasing the amount of eCash tokens in a very, very small amount, you know, making a small amount. And eventually we get to this, you know, more extreme fractional reserve point over a decade. This would create an incentive where it's very cheap to verify against that. If you apply this to like analog banking situations, it's like, how do people create and automate bank runs on a bank in our system today? You can't. It's just like, you don't even know who, like, there's no way to like actually automate these kind of things. And then when you consider the withdrawals and the crisis that occurred at the beginning of this year or last year, with the most recent banking crises, like, they were blaming that stuff on mobile money schemes. And they're saying, oh, the runs are happening so much more rapidly because of mobile money. It's like, imagine what we can create in this system and what runs would look like. And that's what, when I started thinking about it this direction, I'm like, damn, like, this is going to be really friggin' efficient. I don't know if you can, unless like there's an economic benefit of running a fractional reserve institution that I don't particularly seem aware of, but we can always have credit issued in other ways. It doesn't have to be through fractional reserve. And unless that's the case, I would presume that we're probably going to create a system so efficient that we're not really going to see that happening, unless it's fraud or something.
Yeah, and there's no lender of last resort in this model either. So that just increases the risk way more. It's like,
and there's a self-sovereign peer-to-peer competitor as well. Mm-hmm. And that increases it even more too.
Yeah. And so how do you... I'm just curious, because I'm curious of this as well, just to see it play out. I'm sure we'll see over the next year or two how it does. And unfortunately, due to the regulatory landscape that exists in the world right now, it'll probably be more underground, more small niche communities building these mints. But in your ideal vision of Fedee mints succeeding to the level that we believe they can, what does it look like? Is it a world of communities spinning up their own mints and having community members join them and doing the Uncle Jim model, the Guardian model that Fedee's really going after? Or do you see, do you see this becoming more professionalized where you have maybe Bitcoin companies with good reputations become Federation members and spin up mints with other companies that they trust and others trust in the space? Or is it a combination of both?
Yeah. Like, you know, I guess, like, what do I think is most likely? It's like, there's a lot of things I think I could see. When it comes to what I think is most likely, it's like, where do I see Bitcoin in 10 years? I see some sort of like consortium of developing economies that are all opting into this neutral system and actually conducting trade and holding reserves in it. And it's kind of reached a critical mass and it's in the tens of trillions type value range. And I think that within those kind of economies, we'd probably see federated eCash based community custodial models that exist. And obviously, like within the KYC AML world, the question's like, okay, well, is eCash the ideal method that would be leveraged as like a form of like, you know, de facto note issuance within developing economies? And that's something I don't know. I think like, I guess like, I don't know. My current thinking around it is basically, I think that if we want to have, I think in those kind of environments, like if you're in a situation where you have to participate in KYC AML, then that requires a degree of auditability, in which case the eCash privacy, I think, is still valuable on a peer-to-peer basis, but you know, the federation is going to know who you are. I'm assuming at least they would have to, but that may not be the ideal system, right? It's just like, you probably are going to want some sort of system. And I don't think a blockchain would be the ideal system for that either. It's like, you could have some sort of account based ledger that's, you know, and you could put that into a chain structure of like embedded hashes. But I feel like just having general, you know, certain types of ledgers that are maintained in more of a centralized form and provided, it's the idea of like, you know, private blockchains, but let's not make it a blockchain that requires consensus, because it's just us here. Like, what are we trying to achieve consensus over? I'm in charge. I'm the CEO of the company or whatever it is. I have final say, so let's not beat around the bush and let's just create something more efficient. I guess, yeah, I don't know. That's kind of how I see it at this point.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate. the possibilities, which we should dive into too, because I mean, up to this point in the conversation, we're talking about eCash tokens. You put your Bitcoin into this multi-sig address, you get a commensurate amount of eCash tokens in return. They can use in a peer-to-peer fashion or send to other mints over the Lightning Network. But that's just the base case, most fundamental use case, is using these eCash tokens as cash. But the way the Fediment protocol has been built in a very modular fashion, it enables modules within that can provide what the incumbent banking system provides, but in this distributed system using cryptographic primitives to provide app-like services within the mint. Yeah. And so I've had Theo Mojene on, he wrote the piece before you for Axiom talking about Bitcoin money market funds that could be constructed using DLCs, and within Fediments you can construct DLCs. Stability pools are something that are a hot topic within the Fediment community. They could essentially replace stable coins in terms of probably using something like a DLC contract for difference to create a stable value within a mint for people who don't want to take the price volatility risk of Bitcoin, want to lock in a stable US dollar value. When they launched version 0.2.1 last week, they announced that there's a prediction market module. Like, how extensible is the Fediment protocol? Like, what kind of sci-fi things could we build?
Yeah, that's a good question. I definitely don't want to act like I'm any sort of authority on this. I'd assume you probably actually know more about it than I would. But I think that there's, I think just like, once again, going back to the idea that like eCash is kind of an ideal means of payment. And because it's built in a way that's very modular, there's, I would assume that like most automated forms of smart contracting would be leveraging a system similar to this. And I think that because of that, like, yeah, I think like the biggest thing, I think stability pools is cool. My concern is that I can see like, when I think about like the end users, it's like, sure, like, obviously for like Bitcoin specific users, there's going to be a ton of people like, I want that. Our local bit devs meetup out here in Denver, we want to get a federation set up and we want to, you know, transact with eCash between us. We already have our de facto guardians within the group who control the multi-sig as it is right now. And that seems like something that's really compelling, particularly if we could take a stability pool type position within that stack over time, that would be awesome. There's a lot of use cases that we would use for that. And I think that like for the broader mass market though, like I guess for like listeners in terms of background, you know, like Tether is just making way too much money. As stable coins come into more competition, they're going to be enticing people by passing along the money that they're making on the reserve assets through the coin itself and providing an interest rate, just like, you know, it's like a neo bank emerging within the same system. And I think the challenge is that you're going to be competing against fiat economics with those interest rates. To the average consumer, that's like, you know, APY here versus APY here, I want higher one, you know, hold this stable coin. I think that I wonder how competitive stability pools will be in the market, because it's going to be more like paying a cost to have stability over time. And I think that, like, while, you know, while the exact same economic game is being played in the last crypto crisis, I think that, you know, the fiat type economic system is going to take a little bit longer to get away than, you know, what like Mashinsky and some of these other guys were trying to do. So it's like, I think that that's kind of one of the, I'm really curious to see how that aspect in the market develops over time. But I think that it's going to be a really valuable utility that exists within the system. In terms of like other things that are emerging, I like, once again, going back to the idea of like, it's just a technology and there's a lot of different ways that it can emerge. I think that like it could be a system where, you know, like there's a lot of like collateralized lending that starts to exist. I think that by bringing together people in this like banking or monetary type format, there is other forms of lending or uncollateralized lending that could start to emerge within community functions. I think that like, while there's quite a bit of needs, particularly within like the developing economy world, there's definitely like a big capital problem. And perhaps these types of systems that aren't as regulated and are circumventing the traditional banking system could actually create like a funnel for new forms of capital to flow within these regions. And I think that that's like one of the particularly interesting use cases of Fedimint.
Yeah. I can't keep but hearkening back to the fact that the regulatory environment is such where this sort of has to, you can't really go balls deep in this as like a builder here in the US, because it's,
yep,
the privacy really scares people.
Yep.
But I think over time, again, technology always wins out. I think this will be something that proliferates and wins massively. And it's a bit contrarian in the Bitcoin space. I mean, a lot of people, that's another funny thing. They're like, Fedimint's been talked about for 2 years. There's nothing to show for it. It's probably not going to have much success. Like, this federated model's stupid. It's like, eh, it took a couple of years. Yes, it's been talked about for a couple of years, but like we mentioned, the first stable release just came out last week or 2 weeks ago. Now at this point, that was last week. And we're only getting to the point where you can actually build cool things on this.
Yep.
And it's crazy because, again, juxtaposing it to the incumbent banking system, you can create better experiences and more secure experiences by distributing risk, not only within a mint, but amongst multiple mints. So, I mean, maybe we should jump down that rabbit hole. Is like, how do you view individuals interacting with Chaumian mints? Will they have a go-to mint, or do you think they'll distribute that risk among many mints, maybe two, three, maybe even a dozen that provide specific services?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that like, there's going to be like highways and, roads and streets that emerge. You're probably going to have like commercial scale type Fedimints. And once again, a Fedimint's just one technology, right? Like, we could, a Fedimint could also very easily create, or, you know, create some sort of like auditability type module. You can build anything, and have it, you know, be interactive with this protocol. So like, I could see a, you know, quote unquote Fedimint, or just banking infrastructure in general that is a part of the Fedimint protocol for one reason, that is acting as like an exchange based type service. And I could see that being an institution that's also probably a Lightning service provider, and is, you know, any other protocols that are relevant to interact within the network, they're probably going to be participating in some form. It's like, we're having this proliferation where I think, you know, the idea of like a bank, quote unquote, is really just like a service provider. And there's different protocols in which they're going to interact with. And there's different ways that they can extract value as like a business model. So like that, going back to like kind of like that money market type model of like the Bitcoin native money markets that are emerging, that's a really big idea. I think we need to get to like that very first catalyst in terms of means of payment before these really start to grow and expand and become material. But, you know, Lightning routing and liquidity leasing fees is a money market. And then Lightning operators that are market making between Lightning and eCash is also a market. And as you go further down the risk curve towards, you know, collateralized lending and then off-chain lending, there's all these different money markets that are going to start to emerge in a digitally native fashion. And by being able to commit your capital directly into protocols that allow us to earn some type of interest, or peer-to-peer marketplaces that allow us to earn a type of interest, it's like we're creating these money markets relevant or that are a part of a means of payment system that we haven't before. It's like by conducting, let's assume that within our current banking system, we have like the cashier's check. And within the cashier's check market, there's some level of fees that banks are consistently earning on an annual basis, and the banks are all capturing it. Well, now it's like peer-to-peer participants are probably going to have access into those capital markets as well directly. And the banks won't be as much of an intermediary. It'll be more just like peer-to-peer capital markets. And like, that's really cool, because I think that that's going to create these virtuous cycles of growth within the capital markets over time. But going back to my point, like, I feel like all those things stem on like, what's the first use case? And there's all these use cases that have kind of emerged in like crypto world that I don't perceive as sustainable use cases, or at least not in a material way. And I think the question is like, what's the first one? And maybe that's AI leveraging Lightning for AI agents. And maybe that's global remittances leveraging the Lightning network, or maybe they're leveraging eCash at some point too. I can see, I think when you get into the weeds of how that works, I think that eCash could potentially be a viable way of achieving their goals of moving collateral from one legal entity in one country to a legal entity in another country and circumventing the banking system. And it wouldn't have a inbound liquidity constraint. All the fees that are extracted from operating in these new means of payment, those fees create the capital market over time. And then as we get capital markets, more investors come in. As more investors come in, more people participate, more people become end users, so on and so forth. And I think that like, that's probably one of the major killer apps that's going to come out of a lot of this, but still waiting on that catalyst.
Yeah. Who's going to be the one that flicks the domino and gets all this started? Yeah.
I think we're getting close too, man. Like, things are getting wild. I think this could be the year that we really.
Why do you say that?
I think we're building that. I think from like, and I don't want to harp on like the whole like crossing the chasm ETF thing. It's like there's plenty enough around that. But I think like this is what I'm looking at, is like the crossing the chasm moment. Is just like, I think that there is a bit of a critical mass, and there are going to be enough tools within the next, I'll say, year or two, to where we could see a consumer level catalyst. Going back to the, like the two points I'm making, like if we see like something like AI or something like remittance markets or you know, some other form of adoption really take off, and I feel like we are getting close. Part of it's an intuition, but you know, I definitely think that there's a lot being built and there's a critical mass. And in Bitcoin's, because it's crossing this chasm of like legitimacy in the more regulated markets, that is probably going to change the way that it's perceived and by the public when we do start to have like a catalyst moment from one of these new like payment means or store value use cases. And I think that there's like a pretty big moment coming from that. And I feel like that's when things are going to get really, really wild. And it's not just going to be from like BlackRock buying our bags.
No, that's actually the contrarian take right now too, because everybody again is convinced that BlackRock entering all the ETFs launching is the end of self-sovereign cypherpunk Bitcoin. But I think this is just the beginning when you consider the protocols that are emerging. Obviously Lightning's been around, Liquid's been around, Fediment's finally launched, and another proposal right now, and I know Barack's working on it, but another sort of technology, another second layer solution that you discuss in the piece is ARK. And admittedly, I've been only following it at arm's length and haven't really dove into the details of the design of that particular layer and how it would work. So I don't think we've ever talked about ARK on TFTC or Rabbit Hole Recap, maybe in passing on Rabbit Hole Recap, but I think this would be a good opportunity to dive into ARK, what it is conceptually, and what sort of problems it would solve, because it does make different trade-offs, obviously, and does do things better than Lightning and Fediments do in some ways.
Yeah. So the first thing, I'll give a disclaimer that I'm not the best person to be describing ARK, but I can talk about some things at like a high level. And it's definitely unique in some ways and complex. And I really don't have any sort of certainty or firm opinion on it. But like we were, it's interesting. And I could see some, there's some valuable things that I can talk about with it is what I'll say. But like, I think that, part of the disclaimer, it's an emerging protocol. It requires a soft fork really to be usable in any legitimate way. And I think that, when I decided to include it in the paper, I think it's just because it seems like while Fediments are like this, trusted form of, you know, potential banking services emerging, I think that ARKs are like, they do have potential to be like a trustless version or similar to Lightning, trust minimized type version with, you know, unilateral withdrawal from the protocol existing as a property. And I think that that's pretty cool. And, you know, I didn't talk about rollups. I'm still learning about rollups. But I think that that's something else that requires a soft fork that would be, you know, potentially, applying a similar quality. But basically what an ARK is you're creating this agreement with an ARK service provider, and that's a person or a group that has Bitcoin, and you're creating an agreement with them where you say, okay, we are going to enter into this multi-sig with a time expiry on it. And it might be just me and you, it might be me and 100 other people as well, all getting into this multi-sig, and, you know, similar to like a channel factory is an onboarding mechanism. And that's kind of value proposition number one, but requires soft work, and it's not like anything distinct. There's without ARK or no ARK, there's ways that we can accomplish that same goal anyways to any protocol. But that's one part of the value proposition is that you can minimize on-chain footprint. And then when you enter into this, the ARK service provider provides a pre-signed transaction to you so that you can exit out of the protocol when you choose with that multi-sig agreement. But the goal would be to have you stay in the protocol, and if you remain within the protocol, it's basically they can conduct swap payments on your behalf so that you can pay people either at that are also, you know, compatible with the ARK protocol. And they call these VTXOs, virtual transaction outputs, where you're just trading pre-signed transactions. Now, because of the nature of the way it works, when a swap payment is done, the ARK service provider has to, the amount of capital required to conduct payments within an ARK is effectively double the amount that is deposited within it. So that's where you run into a problem. And that's where people are kind of like debating, you know, will this be viable? And that was like the primary criticism of it, I think. But that basically means that, and this isn't the right number, but like in theory, it's like if 10.5 million Bitcoin were all to exist in ARK service providers, that would be the maximum that could happen, because the service provider needs the other 10.5 million to be able to conduct swap transactions. And that's where I get into some of the problems is like, while one of the goals of ARK was to remove this inbound liquidity constraint that Lightning has, and that was kind of the cool part. But I think the problem is that the burden does get passed along to an ARK service provider. So it's kind of like almost, and I guess I don't know if this is completely right, but I think it's somewhat like centralizing the liquidity requirements in a way, which is kind of already naturally happening within Lightning service providers. But by doing that, they can just basically conduct payments for you the way that you want with these virtual pre-signed transactions. And anybody can take that and they can call that slip and they can unilaterally exit at any time. So like the one thing that I thought was kind of interesting is like I think ARC service providers don't really make any sense when you think about them at a small scale, but as you scale them more, it actually kind of could make sense. And these are just like, I have these like swag estimates in there with a little like paper model that I built around what it could look like. But it's like, if we kind of like, you know, assume certain transaction values of Bitcoin, then we can assume what like the ultimate transaction throughput of an ARC service provider could eventually become. And I think when Bitcoin's valued less, right? Like, if the average transaction size, let's go to like one extreme, right? It's like one Bitcoin, then, you know, transactions per second is pretty much on par with Bitcoin's throughput of like six transactions per second. And then, but as Bitcoin becomes more valuable, the average transaction within a system is less and less on a Satoshi basis. And I think that that's kind of an interesting idea, because as Bitcoin grows and becomes more valuable, and let's assume that, you know, for sake of argument, that the average transaction size, like globally across all payments, is somewhere like $100 or whatever it is, that as that is represented by less and less Satoshis, the higher the transaction throughput of an ARC service provider becomes in terms of like its theoretical threshold of capital required. So like in today, it's like, well, 10.5 million Bitcoin, the total value of payment settled isn't that much. But if, you know, the Bitcoin as an asset is worth 100 trillion one day, now all of a sudden it starts to get pretty interesting. We're like, you know, 100 bits worth of average transaction size, you know, if that is like your average amount, then like, you know, 60,000 transactions per second is closer to where it could be. And that's on par with like a credit card company. And then if we get higher and higher, if we reach like SAT parity or something like that, the numbers start to get a lot bigger. So I kind of just think it was like an interesting way of thinking about maybe as like a long-term, very, very long-term type thing. But a lot of people were talking about it when I was writing this, and I decided to dive into it. And there's a lot of other things I didn't include in this paper that, you know, I would have if I had all the time in the world, but I'm getting to those.
Yeah, admittedly, I've been a bit apprehensive to dive into ARC, because it is,
yeah,
complex might be the right word, but it is it's like a whole nother level of sort of system design that,
yeah,
I need to take the time to sit down and actually like read through and understand specifically.
So it's been the same thing with BitVM for me. I'm just like, I need to punch that one out soon, but I feel like it's just so different.
Yeah. No, I mean, in your final thoughts in the essay too, I thought you put it very presciently too, like visualizing what this would look like. Like, I'm just going to read from the final thoughts, spoiler if you're planning on reading this and haven't yet, but imagine a system where users dollar cost average into Bitcoin via ARC, use federated technology for custody and eCash as the private cash balance for everyday transactions, and on the back end, all service providers are clearing balances between one another via the Lightning Network. Fediments and ASPs could act as banking infrastructure, and the Lightning Network could act as clearinghouse amongst them as a hub and spoke model. Further, competition and information transparency are fostered by technologies like Web of Stakes, reputation management systems, and expiring eCash proof of reserve systems. Like, that is incredibly sci-fi in the future I want to see.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess I kind of missed the punch on that. I should have gone into that as like the sci-fi detail, but like that's basically me just trying to draw, like, in free banking systems, you had banks, brokers, clearinghouses, net settlement between all these different groups, speculators who try to put banks out of business. I think that all of that's emerging at a protocol level, and I'm trying to like draw comparisons for like how these functions that have always existed are emerging in a new way and a better way.
Yeah. And so what do you think is going to take? I mean, obviously we've talked about the catalyst, and the emerging market is probably a good place for this to start, just because they need something like this desperately. It's a step function improvement of what they're using, and it will enable capital inflows that have not been possible to date. But what do you think about here in the West? Do you think we get on board with this technology anytime soon?
I feel like in the West, I could see it actually emerge. Like, I mean, I guess it depends on your timeline, but I guess like where I'm thinking tomorrow, like, you know, like I was saying earlier, I think our local meetup wants to use something just like this. And it's like, I think if you have like commons or you have whatever you got and people are conducting payments all the time, peer to peer, it's like, if you have your own like federation set up and people are just effectively leveraging that and using these low cost e-cash payments, like, I think that's pretty cool. That's how I'll probably start using it. And yeah, in terms of like other things, you know, I know that some people are thinking that there's like an institutional use case for like federated technology in general. And I think that that could make sense with like how you can leverage federated consensus, to like optimize for how security is conducted within an organization, right? Like that's a great way of thinking about like what is shared custody. It's like, well, every organization is a form of shared custody. There's different permissions, there's different levels, and there's different, you know, quote unquote keys or passwords that people hold to be able to move funds on behalf of a group. And there's potential for this to be used. I guess going back to my point earlier, though, my hesitance with that is I don't know if eCash is necessarily the best medium for those types of use cases.
Yeah, I mean, like, just multi-institution, bland vanilla multi-sig makes a lot of sense for that, especially if it's the institutional level and you're dealing with a lot of money. Like on-chain transactions are probably worth it. If you're using a Taproot multi-sig, it's cheaper than Wrap SegWit or something like that. So, yeah, it is crazy. That's another whole topic. Like, before we even get to, like, the sci-fi Fediment, like, just one simple low-hanging fruit is making multi-institution multi-sig the standard.
Even
like with these ETFs all going to Coinbase, like, God forbid, don't think it's going to happen. I think the history of Zappo and Coinbase acquired Zappo, and Zappo, obviously founded by Wences and Ted Rogers, did an incredible job of creating security protocols to ensure that they can protect your private keys. But God forbid Coinbase were to somehow get exploited, their cold storage at least, and you have what people are saying will be tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars over the next few years flow into these ETFs that are leveraging Coinbase. Like, that would be terrible. Like, distribute that risk among multiple institutions. Very low hanging fruit.
Right. Yeah. Which is kind of like an interesting idea of, and I was thinking about this, in terms of Fediments, is there could be an avenue as well where you separate minting from custody. And that can create kind of a check and balance on the system.
Interesting.
But I don't know if that'd be something that would ever like naturally emerge, but I've kind of thought about if there's a separation of custody from, you know, pretty much everything else in some format, then you might have parties with a competing interest that are, you know, fulfilling both of those functions, and that might be a good like check on the system.
How would that work?
Well, I think that like e-cash minting is technically arbitrary, right? So it's like, you could just be a mint and you would have like, you know, say like a separate custodial provider who is the federation. They're just like, we're the guys, you have like your guardians hold the keys, but you don't have your guardians actually minting the e-cash. I don't know how in like the current Fediment architecture that could actually work. It's more of like a theoretical idea. And perhaps it actually is a simple thing. I've never really talked with those guys about it. But I've kind of wondered if like you're to be like, okay, we're this Fediment, we mint this e-cash, our custody is actually held by, you know, some other group, whoever it is. And, as long as you know, the same way that other custodial, it could be like based on like trusted legal agreements between two organizations. Like at the end of the day, as long as somebody controls the funds, there's a risk of rug, but it doesn't really have to be the mint. And, you know, profits and, contracts oftentimes I think solve most issues, but yeah.
Interesting. So with an end user, I'm trying to think of how there's two ways I could see this going. End user takes Bitcoin, goes to a federation that's handling the custody, puts the Bitcoin in there. They take the Bitcoin, give it to the mint, get eCash tokens in return. The mint has the Bitcoin for doing that service. Or you could just have the user go straight to the mint and say, hey, I want this many eCash tokens in this mint, and they just mint them and send it to the custody. That could be fascinating.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's no different than, right, like major, you know, it's like the financial service providers in the industry today who use like, who've used like Prime Trust or, you know, any of these other third party custodial providers. Could be something similar to that.
Yeah. Fascinating. It's a brave new world, Eric Yeeks. What do you think about all this ETF stuff? Noise?
No, I mean, look, I'm contrarian, right? Like, I think that the benefits don't need to necessarily be spoken to of the ETF. Like, you know, I think that there's obviously a ton of indirect benefits. I did a thread this summer when it was first popping up, just basically trying to walk through the idea of like, I don't know. My take is I'm not sure that there is, I'm not sure, like some people that are very excited about it, I'm not sure that it isn't something that could become a big, scary problem within a few years. I think depending on how rapidly capital starts flowing in through these vehicles, like I think we could get to a material influential point in the market. And like at the end of the day, I think influencing Bitcoin is, it's just a purely social consensus, or not social, but it's a purely consensus based. And there's all these different layers of consensus. You know, there's investor, developer, miner, social. There's all these things that exist. And as really big players enter the community in a rapid way, that also hold the keys to freedom in other aspects, right? Like BlackRock is a very influential company. It's one of like the most influential companies in the world. Having them become a major stakeholder within the ecosystem in a variety of different forms, I think it's a scary proposition, and I don't know where that could lead, but I think that some people are like, oh, it's fine, it creates a demand, they're gonna buy our bags and all that. I don't think it's that simple. I think there are legitimate concerns, and like this goes back to the point around we like building out the self-sovereign peer-to-peer system. It needs to happen. It's happening, but I think that like we really need to be prioritizing it more and more. I think that we're kind of getting to this inflection point in growth, and I am concerned about what that could do to the undermining freedom enabling properties of Bitcoin if Wall Street gets pretty influential.
Agree. I completely agree there. That's why I'm happy we're talking about this today in the midst of all this ETF madness. This is where the signal is in my mind.
Yeah, man, it's like, yeah, I don't know. But I mean, it's awesome, man. Like it's kind of, it's pretty surreal. I remember when I first got into all this, and like, it was cool to me that the Winklevoss twins were on CNBC talking about Bitcoin. I remember like, oh shit, like this is awesome for Bitcoin. They're on CNBC, and now it's like, we're in everything all the time. I mean, even during the bear market.
CNBC is like a Bitcoin podcast network these days.
I know. It's crazy. Yeah.
It is funny. Like thinking back to when I got in, like, I think my big, like, oh shit, we made it moment was like Coinbase launched their debit card and you could like use Bitcoin backed debit card to buy stuff. I was like, oh, we made it. It's here. That's the thing. I've been around Bitcoin for 10 years now. And that's the one thing I've kind of like, it's all right. It's a long journey.
Damn, 10 years. That's sweet, man.
We've come a long way. We're 15 years in now. It's going to happen. It's going to take longer than you originally expect, but it's going to happen much quicker than most people expect as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's everything since I got into this industry. I feel like everything I've expected has happened drastically more quickly. And I feel like all we are is a press release away from some sort of crazy new thing happening. And it's also funny too, because, you know, I jumped into all this basically. I started writing my book in 2020. I really started like talking to a lot of people in the industry in like 2021. But I'm kind of like a last cycle guy. and I'm just like a noob, but like, it's kind of funny because I'm starting to like, this is my first news cycle with a bunch of people coming in, and I'm like starting to see all the parallels and everything. And like, you know, I was following things from a distance back in 2017. So this is like, it's very different being involved in the industry and having that perspective.
What were you doing before?
So I was working for a private equity fund. So before that I was at FTI Consulting. And I actually was a few years before Parker was there. He was in the exact same group I was in. So
oh, really?
The boss that I worked for at my private equity fund was in Parker's class at our last company. They were friends. But yeah, it was funny when I got into this, and then I was talking to one guy at our group, and he's like, oh, like you should talk to Parker Lewis.
And so funny.
Yeah. Parker directed me to the Bitcoin Standard and everything. Cause like back then I was definitely a lot more like, I wasn't like, I definitely saw the value in Bitcoin, but I was like way more open-minded to the rest of crypto. And it was Parker kind of pushing me Bitcoin Standard direction that really helped me like be like, oh, I see. Okay. It's not all the narratives being told.
No. Money will converge to one. He just gave that presentation today at the Commons.
Yeah.
But no, it's fascinating how quickly these cycles come, and I've got pattern recognition. I think there's a third or fourth cycle now. It's like, holy shit. It's all happening again.
Yeah, it's wild, man.
But another thing back to the ETF and like the whole, I agree with your long-term worries about the influence that BlackRock and others can have on Bitcoin's consensus layer, the social consensus specifically, and try to use their ability to throw around capital to try to force Bitcoin to do things. But I do also think this week was an incredible advertisement for Bitcoin. Like you had the SEC.
Yeah, it's so cool.
You had the SEC fumbled the announcement like three times. And then today, like apparently behind the scenes, I'm not sure if you're hearing this, but it's complete chaos behind the scenes in terms of the APs. Obviously you have Vanguard not allowing people to buy.
Yeah.
The SEC fuck up is a complete validation of the fact that the government's completely incompetent and you shouldn't be trusting them, and who are they to regulate all this stuff and tell us what to do and what money we can use and what financial products we can get access to. And then the launch today and the stark reminder of trusted third party risk with people like Vanguard saying like, no, you can't buy these ETFs. It's not in, not in our mandate. It's like, it's poetic.
It's poetic, man. It's so cool. I was hanging out with my friend and I was just like, I can't believe it. It always is like this too. It's like, there's just, it's like the movie's unfolding. And, I like tweeted, I was like, Gensler looks like such a joke now. They're definitely going to have like some absurd character play him in the movie. It's going to be like Will Ferrell or something. And he's just going to act like a crazy asshole or something. And like, it's wild, man. I couldn't believe it. What I thought was so badass was Hester Pierce's statement.
Yeah.
That just letter.
Complete counter signal immediately after his letter.
Yeah. That was really cool. And it's just like, we have this divided house for the securities regulator of the largest capital markets in the world. And that's such a canary in the coal mine for the reality of what's happening within fiat world that I think a lot of people are actually starting to see, and it's becoming mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, you have that, we're rolling into an election cycle. I have been thinking about Rome a lot lately. My wife asked me any day over the last month, yes, I've been thinking about Rome, honey. But the one thing, like whether it's like the house divided at the SEC or just other signal, obviously inflation's high, but the one that's really like stuck in my mind for the last month is I saw a trend of active duty military members like going on TikTok. There was like a TikTok trend of these military members basically on duty somewhere in the world, like telling others, like, don't join the army, the money's not worth it. And that's like the one thing that led to the sacking of Rome was like when they couldn't pay their overextended military. They did pay them, it was in bunk metal. But today, fast forward thousands of years, and we're having the same problem here in America. And again, that's a canary in the coal mine that not many people have picked up on, when your military servicemen and women are actively telling others not to join because the pay isn't worth it. Like the money's not worth it. That's a big,
that's story. Wild. I hadn't heard about that. That's interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of canaries out there.
Well, it makes sense too. I mean, like, I'm not an expert. Well, I guess like all my family was military, but like in terms of like the way that it works today, I'm not as familiar. But like, I thought that there's some sort of, with all of the like school, the education promised from is, you know, military compensation, that they basically have all these restrictions on it so that you can pretty much only do these like bullshit online universities that don't really get you anywhere. Or I don't know if that's actually the case, but I was getting that impression.
Yeah. Yeah. it's happening. And then like you look at the stat I ran last week doing a like retrospective on the first 15 years focused on the financial system, like the ratio of national debt to M2 in 2009 when Bitcoin launched was 1.26. We were at 8.7 trillion in M2 and 10.7 in national debt today. Fast forward to January 2024, that ratio is 1.68. We're at 21 trillion in M2 and 34 trillion in debt. And so if you're just thinking of something, that ratio needs to revert to the mean back towards 1.26, the monetary base is going to have to expand. This inflation problem is not going away, no matter how much the Biden administration would like you to believe that.
Yeah, it's going to be wild, man. But I'm ready, man. It's going to be a good year. I'm excited.
It is going to be a good year. Eric, long time coming. I'm happy we waited, though, because I think this is a fascinating topic. We'll have to do it more. You'll have to come do it in person. We'll have to figure out.
Yeah, man. I do plan on getting down to Austin at some point, like I think first half of this year. So definitely.
Come through the Commons. It's a good vibe here. Great vibes today. We're going to link to this piece in the show notes. We'll link to your book as well. What else do you want the freaks to know before we wrap up here? Any final thoughts? Anywhere you want to send people?
Just Twitter. Follow me. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I run my life out of the DMs on Twitter for the most part. So yeah, just hit me up there. It's just my name. And yeah, that's it.
We'll link to that as well. Eric, keep crushing it. We're going to win. Crazy time to be alive.
Hell yeah. Thanks, man.
All right. Peace and love, freaks. Tiki.